Welcome to Mentoring Moments. Mentoring Moments is a sub-series of the E-Commerce Edge podcast. It is composed of clips taken from Jason's one-to-one and group mentorship sessions. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome Neil Twa to the podcast. Welcome, Neil.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for having me, man.
My pleasure to have you along for the ride today. We're talking about off air that you are in the great state of Missouri, in Branson. And you said that you grew up there. You didn't grow up there. You were there until the age of two, and that you lived in multiple other places around the country, but you're now back in Branson. And for those that maybe are not that familiar with Missouri, but they may be familiar with the TV series Ozark, you are actually in the Ozarks. So just
we're Ozark Mountains. We're about an hour from Branson. So anybody who wants to know if we do drugs or a part of anything in the Ozark show that I've never even seen, I've just heard enough about it to get it. Yeah, we're not even part of that, by the way.
No, you're actually the opposite of that. You're a card carrying, proud, flag waving American, and you homeschool your kids and you have built this business, this online business that now affords you the freedom to live the lifestyle that you want. And that's why I wanted to get you on the podcast as a guest mentor to talk about your journey, to talk about how, I guess, going from a place where perhaps you were beholden to other people and other organizations, because, you know, you are, at the end of the day, you are one of the largest tech companies in the world. You're IBM. But for the last nearly 17 years via Voltage Holdings, you have not only built your own brands and help them to be successful on Amazon, but now you've evolved your entire business. You provide marketing services, but you also acquire brands, help them to become even more successful, and then you then sell them on. And so you, I guess, help to buy, build, sell online brands. Mm-hmm. And this is something I think that a lot of brands hope that they ultimately can build something that is attractive to someone like you, attractive enough, but still with enough growth potential, because there's that fine line, right? If they feel like they've maximized their growth potential and you feel like they've maximized their growth potential, then maybe you feel like they're not worth acquiring because I don't feel like I can move the needle enough to add enough value to make them then resellable on a flip basis.
Correct.
So I wanted to talk through with you today, what are the types of things you typically look for in these businesses that you acquire? Yeah. And as I understand it, most of them are Amazon businesses, primarily, at least when you find them. They may even be Amazon-only businesses or Amazon-primarily businesses. And what I wanted to talk about today is, what do you look for in some of these brands? If I'm a brand out there and I'm on Amazon and maybe I'm an FBA business, and I'm looking to make myself attractive for acquisition, someone like you. And look, we've seen massive disruption in this industry. We've seen Thrasio go under. We've seen lots of these roll-up businesses that have acquired 20, 30 FBA businesses. They thought they could bring economies of scale to those businesses, mash them all together, and take perhaps marginally successful FBA businesses. And by mashing them all together, we turn them into this great behemoth. But we've actually seen, when money isn't free and when capital isn't free anymore, that model doesn't work. And it's been very interesting to watch how many, when the tide goes out, you see who's swimming naked, I think is the saying. We found a lot of brands. We found a lot of brands were swimming naked. And
a lot of brands,
is that what you're finding now? And are you finding that a lot of those formerly successful Amazon brands are now distressed? And are you typically coming in and finding them as a distressed asset, acquiring them as a distressed asset, bringing your skills and experience in marketing to the table, building them back up again, and then being able to sell them off once you've created a whole ton of enterprise value? Is that your modus operandi?
Yes, it is, in very simple terms. We obviously, there's distressed brands, there's brands that are normalized in terms of growth. They may have a 3-5% growth organically every year, but that's only matching inflation. So we're looking for brands that are typically doing 10, 20, 30% organic growth or above inflation, but considered growth in the market through whatever channels and mechanisms they're selling. I prefer they have at least 10 to 20% off Amazon channel open in some capacity that maybe hasn't been exploited due to limitations of funding or intellectual capital in the operator who's, you know, unable to open them correctly and hit their max, as you mentioned. But I don't particularly like turnarounds. I know some people do. They want to buy a turnaround. They think it's great. They're going to show who they are, and they're going to turn this business around. And it's going to be like, oh, we bought it at a 1X and it was on its way down.
A turnaround story.
A 5X and we turned it around and look at this, really a turnaround story. Like, they need that. That's an ego-driven thing. I don't care about that. What I want to see is a good business that's growing or stabilizing. And really, if I can speak to the operator and understand who they are and what they know about the business, and they know their numbers, then I will have more confidence when I look at the P&L and we dissect the business that I'm actually going to find profit, opportunity, and growth, and at least 5 to 7 key metrics that we're going to look at for this business to turn it into a successful flip. And that may take 2 to 3 to 5 years, but we know the upside potential is built into the baked into that cake because the operator knows what they're doing. If I go to the operator and talk to them and ask them what their numbers are and they don't know, or they're confusing gross margin with net margin or net profit, I'm like, sorry, like I can already tell your finances aren't going to look good and your operations are not going to be great either. So there are indicators to those businesses that we're looking for when we determine whether or not they're acquisition friendly. Do the same thing on the beginning side, to your point, at the stage of developing ideation and growth. We're looking for market competition, obviously low saturation, but we're looking for products that have multiple opportunities for a circle of influence or circle of confidence in them. So they may have a particular connectivity to, say, in my world, homesteading, but they're homesteaders who maybe do canning and there's others who don't. So if I can connect a homesteader who also does canning, then I can connect all the gear, accessories, and homesteading supplies that would supply that person with multiple products that develop the brand. And if I can identify that at ideation stage and then market test that into the market without marrying any of those products, if they don't run the numbers great, then don't marry them. And then see that actually turn from a product-based business, which 0 to 100K in products is completely doable. This in today's world, it's insane if you don't. Because there's so many opportunities out here. You just don't get confused, people. Like, there's so much noise. It's just buy a product and sell a product. Keep it pretty simple. Then you have the opportunity to grow it into a brand. And brands are where you move systems and processes and methodologies in place that allow you to go from products to a brand. And really what we talk about is brand. So many people talk about products. What's your first product? Go order this. And that's all the hopium mindset guru nonsense crap. You need to be thinking about a brand. We've launched test 5 products in the marketplace. When we test market, okay, we will find the winners. It's an investment strategy that many people don't talk about. I will put $5 million into a company when all those perfect things look really great. And I'll bring it to my PE groups and my home offices and say, hey, this is one we think we should buy because all of these things look really great. It's a bit of a unicorn. But we will look at that as an investment strategy on the other side of the house and say, okay, great. I'd rather buy 5 $1 million companies, okay, and see 2 of them do average, 1 fail. One might go, yeah, and the last one's going to do more than all the rest of them combined because it's a law of averages. It's a law of numbers.
And power law.
Case, yep. You've got to go through and define those metrics. And we can talk about some of that as we go forward. What's the metrics of a business acquisition? For us, it's got to be more than $1 million to $3 million plus in EBITDA or that much in seller discretionary earnings. Whatever the top end revenue at that point is, it is what it is. I know people like to be like, that's a $40 million company. And I'm like, great. It spent $39.9 million operating. Who cares? Right? This is not sexy. Mm-hmm. We want to know what the right numbers are. For us, it's got to be between 15 to 18% minimum. If it's 15 at the bottom line of net income against mm-hmm. operations, it has to be able to get to 18 to 20. If it's 18 to 20, can we get it to 21 or 22 or normalize or stabilize? So you mentioned growth is great, but stabilization is good too. If I could take a business that's maybe at 20 and turn it into a 22% and just take a 2% optimization, I can have a 2x return on that at time of sale above original buying price, which is a pretty good return. I didn't blow it up into a 30, but at the end of that, it's a great business. It may be a holding company that just continues to work and be held and continues to grow, or may become a great asset for somebody to sell. It's all a matter of which position and person you're going to sell it to at that point and what their investment strategy is. But for us, it's growing the profitable brands in 3 to 5 years to an exit as large as profitably can be made.
And when you typically go into these businesses after you've done your due diligence and you've acquired them, are you typically finding that there are common 1, 2, 3, 4 common areas where you can pretty rapidly pull some
yes.
big levers where you go, okay, maybe it's the logistics side of the business is maybe they need a different 3PL or maybe they need to move to FBA or maybe they need to find a new supplier, a new contract manufacturer. Yeah. Are there some key areas that mm-hmm. you find on a routine basis where brands are getting this wrong just so often? Because, and maybe it's even channel mix. Maybe it's, okay, they're Amazon only today, but they need to add D2C. Or maybe it's Amazon and D2C, but they don't do wholesale. They don't do B2B. So they're not doing Amazon business. They're not looking at some of the other B2B marketplaces because they don't do wholesale today at all. Yeah. Is it that maybe they are just reselling somebody else's goods today, but they maybe need to either move to white label, or maybe they need to move to an in-house designed and branded product instead of just reselling a product that's competing heads up with 50 other sellers on Amazon. So in other words, they need to either curate and or differentiate their product lines. What are the most common things you see these brands getting wrong or not? They don't have the, as you said, they either don't have the financial capital or intellectual capital to be able to look at all these opportunities out there to either optimize or expand and grow their business.
Yep.
What are these common areas that you see that just over and over again, these brands make the same mistakes?
So to back to your point about Thrasio and their interest in terms of the money versus operation experience, they had very heavy operational experience at the very tip top of their business, the people who started it. But after that, they had about 120, 140 job recs open with people they were trying to figure out how to run these companies on SOPs who had no experience in a channel market whatsoever. And so they lacked the experience, but they had the money. Mm-hmm. So in the money pool, they decided somewhere along the road, it appears now that we look back, hindsight's 2020, they decided to just acquire everything for whatever they could get their hands on. And that became the new strategy, no matter whether they could operate it or not. So it became an acquisition heavy problem, right? I think maybe a business strategy that they possibly thought about a restructuring of that debt later on, as the pattern goes now, it may have been the opportunity cost or whatever you want to call it in terms of them going after it. And now an investigative report is coming in on about $300 million of those dollars that may or may not have been used allegedly for fraud in a sort of a slight Ponzi looking scheme. There's an NBC article or a CNBC article that just came out. I think it was a CNBC article. Go check it out. It was Amazon aggregator loses other top execs in a bankruptcy. You go dig into the details of that and read a little bit about what they did wrong with money and people operations. But to your point, that kind of begets the problem that operators have in this type of market. Amazon has become extremely complicated in the last 3 years to run, more so than any time since we started this in 2012. It's become very complicated in its operations, logistics, and pipeline, its ability to move product just in time and not just overload the FBA warehouse with anything. So people got really slap happy with the whole retail, online, arbitrage, wholesale kind of nonsense and just started overloading Amazon with all kinds of product. And what actually slingshotted back after last year is they had amazing amounts of returns and refunds from products that weren't even theirs. And so it really overloaded the system terribly. And so now they're saying fees to stop that. They're being putting in certifications for battery types like the button batteries and going after supplements retroactively and saying everyone has to come into a yearly certification now and prove that you have this certification. So they're going to eliminate a bunch of supplements. It's going to open up market share. Cool. It's going to open up market share when they eliminate people through the fees process because they're not truly operating at private label, which you should. If you don't have intrinsic value, if you don't have the IP up to a design or utility patent on your product at some point, you're going to be non-defensible in the market. So to create defense, you have to get up to a patent on your product now. That is not a requirement at the start, but it will be a requirement of staying growth in the market and competing in the market and defending your brand. So that must happen. If we see products that are in a business that we might acquire that have that potential, that's one of the bullet points we're looking for. Could we move them to a design or utility patent? Okay, for brand defensibility, that's going to be the new de facto standard in the coming year on Amazon. Okay. It's just going to need, because so much demand capture is coming in now, up to 30% of television ads, even if they don't say Amazon, are ending up on Amazon. Brand and development strategies from Amazon to TikTok Shop to create brand awareness now are huge, which has really moved Amazon in the last year towards a demand capture platform, like almost exclusively. It used to be brand awareness and demand awareness, but now it's brand capture, which is also the opportunity that Voltage has taken. And since we started our quote unquote as seen on TV strategy, when I launched one of my first successful brands off the back end of an infomercial that wasn't even mine, the infomercial was someone else's. And I just got them on Amazon and captured all that incoming traffic and took over their market share and outmaneuvered them on Amazon. And that became a strategy we look for as part of our process. If those brands are out there and there are other brands competing and buying market share, our goal for acquiring that business is to go capture that market share. Not from the brand itself that was doing it, but they should have a marketing budget.
But the brand that was generating all the demand.
The brand that was being generated by another market that is not being properly captured on Amazon, we can step in front of that traffic and capture it on Amazon as one of our good skill sets. And not a lot of people are paying attention to that. I'm talking about trends. That's different. We're not talking about fidget spinners. We have certain requirements for business and growth and evergreen products. They have to have more than $12 in profit per unit. Preferably 24, 36, 48 or higher. So $50 to $200 plus in retail. That's an opportunity in a company we buy to look and say, okay, if you're not in there, if you're 35, 45, 55, how do we create a 75, 95, $125 version of your product and elevate that brand. That's one of the bullet points we'll look at in terms of the competition of that product, because usually they do not have the skills, capital, or intellectual capital sometimes, or desire to even do or think or test at that level, and we do, and they will not necessarily have the capital to do it. So we do. So we will elevate brands that the operators simply have been unable to elevate. We will go in and do more of the same products in different packaging because they've never expanded their brand out horizontally to capture more of the market share that's moving to get closer to that river of traffic on Amazon, moving 24/7 and 7,800 products a minute. They've been over here on the shoreline trying to coax it in and got close. And of course, they're getting sales and going, but they're literally not in line with that traffic. And once you do, it's a juggernaut of traffic on Amazon. It's huge. And so we look for those data points. Logistics, you mentioned, of course, that's always important because they'll be usually not the most attuned to running a logistic operation. My partner is a logistic guru. He's a genius. He's like, when it comes into just demand, different warehouses, structuring logistics cost and freight and LTL and whether we overnight some and you send some by freight and the whole process he's got down is amazing. It's a genius when it comes to that. And so we've been able to not only keep products in motion, but lower the costs. And when Amazon's fees are going up now, it's actually created market opportunity for us and made us more money. And I kudos to him for being just an operational genius in the way that he structured multiple locations from AWD to AGL to FBA to 3PLs. If you don't know anything I just said, Google's your friend. But the end result is that he's been able to help us create a just-in-time pipeline that I know is super strong. Why? Because we rode it through COVID. And when we had $4,800 plus up to $6,000 in logistical costs on a 40-foot container, that went up to $25,000 on some containers. If you cannot withstand that in your logistical business now, you should be prepared for it to happen again. That's just a forewarning. We're seeing the prices and stuff go up again. If you are not prepared right now and you didn't make it through COVID, good for you. If you started after COVID and you're in that, please listen to me right now. Your business needs to be able to sustain $10,000, $20,000 container, 40-foot container loads of product.
Okay? So it's probably going back there again.
It's probably going back there again. I'm not saying when. I'm saying it's an event. And there are events that lead to when, and it'll happen when it comes. Just there were events that led before. It will go up. And if you cannot sustain it, you won't ride through this. So this is your warning, right? So can you produce that? Can you get that position? Again, we look at that on the build side and we look at it on the buy side. If it's on the buy side, can we move logistics, multiple supply chains, redundancy in logistics, redundancy through operational? Can we reduce costs by creating shared services and voltage? We have shared services in terms of operators who do multiple points, operators that were trained by us, who came up in the business, built a business and have been with us for years, who run companies of their own, who built them from zero with us, are very expert trained. So we know in our way the capacity we have to overcome one of the major fail points that the aggregators had. Now, we went out to become an aggregator, by the way, I should sell this. In 2019, I raised capital. I had two home offices verbally guarantee $50 million in capital by 2021, and we were going to paper. We were going to buy about 53 companies. When by the time that transition occurred through November of 2021, the market had been buying enough past 12, 15 billion in sales. We suddenly saw data that was not privy when we started that process in 2019. So I'm glad that it took that long to raise the capital, frankly, because we didn't follow through on it. We didn't follow through on it. And I'm glad that we did not, because we were going to be an accident if we weren't paying attention to our numbers, buying companies 30, 40% above market share. They were just in buying everything they could get their hands on as fast as they were buying nail brands with $9 nail products. I'm like, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. And so they were just acquiring where they could get. And that obviously has backfired. Consolidation, capitulation, bankruptcy, closure. It's part of the process now. But out of that, we'll strengthen, and out of those ashes, like it normally happens in any major change and shift in marketplace, like the 99 bubble on the internet turned people into stronger tech companies. In this marketed industry, it's going to turn stronger operators out of the base. As we raising voltage back up now and have offices committing capital to purchasing up to 50 companies in the next 5 years, and we're in that process right now, it's a time to buy. There's blood in the streets. There are brands that are great. There are brands we're probably going to end up buying outside from the aggregators because they didn't do a great job and couldn't operate them correctly, but they still have huge upside potential. They just got mismanaged.
They ran out of runway.
Yeah, they ran out of runway. And so there's some good, I have a few friends that are in negotiations to buy back their companies from the aggregators to take them back out to market because they know really what they did wrong and how badly they operated it. So they're going to make it a second pass, which is kind of fun to watch.
And how there's two pieces to this that I think I'd love to better understand through your lens. One is, how important is it now to go to market with a full solution, a bundle, a kit, a stack of products? Because I see that the most successful brands are now getting away from just selling head-to-head one SKU versus another, maybe either competing product or exactly the same product in the market. We're seeing that model is hiding to nowhere, so to speak. And so what we're seeing the smartest brands do is to come to market with solutions, not SKUs.
We always agree with that 100%. Sell solutions in the circle, what I call the circle of confidence around the product, person, and avatar. What they're buying in one segment, they should be buying in another. So you shouldn't go so far as to say launch a kitchen product and launch a pet product.
Yep.
You should launch a kitchen product that has to maybe do something to the home that touches the avatar who might be doing a specific thing, but also does another thing. And so you should be building product, not just bundles per se, but you should be building product into your mind that is complementary to the additional product line. While you can customize, we always do private label, and folks, the difference between white label and private label is just customization at the end of the day.
Yes.
Customize one thing on the product, and then we do a market test with the product. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the sales fixes everything. That's the mantra. So if I can prove that
revenue solves all problems.
If I prove that I can sell this product in the market, I have now accomplished one of the major things. The second thing is making sure Amazon, if I'm going there first, doesn't shut me down. So if I can sell this product and Amazon doesn't shut me down, I'm doing great. The third thing is, any competitor, have I already touched on their market share, and are they willing to do something to stop me? Because there are a lot of unethical marketplace activities happening in the black hat world here, where you start stepping on their market share and they may be willing to pay $5,000-$6,000 to somebody inside of Amazon, a bad actor, to get you shut down. Ask me how I know. So the end result is, when you take that market share, if those three things are not occurring, okay, and you have brand defensibility from registration, trademark, and at least provisional patents that you think you might be able to touch on that product as a brand defense, then you have an opportunity to take it into a full product launch. At a full product launch, I'm now intentionally looking for the products that are solution generated and oriented, and they are typically 50 to 200 in range, that meet the need of that avatar that doesn't just buy on the money alone and not the reviews alone, but is really buying on that emotional connectivity to the brand and the output of that particular product, even if they haven't heard of your brand yet. Mm-hmm. And so we're looking for that solution-based oriented. And those are more evergreen blue sky type of products. Those aren't just everyday kind of products. The data set we pull together and what we call our green light process is both a methodology and a formulaic process of going through the data to determine with at least 80% confidence that I customize a product and put it in the market, someone wants it. My real intention is to determine how much they want from it. And then I'm going to go launch 2, 3, 4, 5 other products in that marketplace, and then determine where the market segment for that product in my account and my price point and my time in the market, even if I have no reviews, is in demand. If I prove that, then it's all upside potential from that point forward. I can go order 1,000 units and do a full product test. And that's what I should do. Now, the same thing applies to an existing company with product or brand lines that are not elevated. Going in and testing other variations of existing product lines is always one of the first things we do outside of the other things I mentioned earlier. They usually are not taking opportunity for product pipeline and differentiation or customization, referred to as innovation, of the product line to move its intellectual property across the line compared to other, you know, chicken or just Me Too products in the marketplace. So yeah, customization is a requirement. So many brands that stabilize or grow basically follow one simple premise, just like Apple: sell more things to more people in the same box. You got an iWatch, you got an iPad, you got an iMac. They sell more of the same thing in different boxes. And that's, in essence, what you're saying brands that are structurally strong are doing, is they're actually executing on that. Now, it's understandably common sense when I tell it to you, hopefully, if you're hearing me today, but it's not common in its execution.
And I think that there's a certain capital requirement to be able to make that happen. And a lot of these brands are hanging on by the skin of their teeth. And so they don't feel like, they feel like it's too risky to be able to go out and do those tests at scale.
And I have a thing for those folks, right? Opportunity begins at the end of your excuses.
Yeah, exactly. Where fear ends, I guess opportunity begins is another way. But how important is the technology, the underlying technology that they use to run their business operationally? How important is that to you, or how important of a lever is that to you? If they're, for example, if they're a, I don't know, let's say they're a $10 million business, a $10 million a year business today, they're running QuickBooks to run their operation. They have no technology in there around analytics. They have no technology in there around logistics. They're running by the seat of their pants. Maybe they have a Shopify D2C store in addition to their Amazon operation. And in fact, maybe they're using Shopify as simply the catalog conduit to get their products listed on Amazon easily because they find Shopify easier to operate operationally than they find an Amazon account to manage. And so they maybe don't have really good, because there were some great third-party analytics tools for Amazon sellers. So I guess just generally speaking, what role does technology play in both assessing the companies you may look to acquire or invest in versus how much of a lever do you see that if they're running poor quality backend systems or processes and you can see, hey, we can insert this type of technology stack in here and it's going to automatically bring a 3% efficiency to the operation.
Operational or operational independent is the theme of your question, if I heard you correctly. And yep. And with that, we're looking for opportunities for operational independence. Now, we've owned 21,000 square foot warehouse and had 12 employees moving, so we know that's not the right way to do it. So if a business is operationally heavy on warehousing and employees, the first thing we're going to look is, does it really need to be there? With the amount of systems and third-party logistic companies now, that when the numbers work correctly, it could be cheaper just to run them without the healthcare cost, the people, employment, manpower, and other problems, we're going to look to turn that lever into an opportunity. When it comes to systems and back in, from my IBM days, having built knowledge latent semantic search engines and engines that eventually powered the web, including part of it from the Watson supercomputer that powered the A9 engine, I understand the technology fundamentally and what it's doing from a data perspective to pull people in and find more data points and gather that information into a sale that literally sells something to somebody in 30 seconds or less. With that, I know that operation is so much more heavy-handed than I can ever go after. It's billions of dollars in infrastructure. And so many of these people don't look at it that way. So what we've done is just said, what is the differentiator? We're not Walmart, but how do we become that little retailer on the side like Trader Joe's who's making more per store per person than Walmart is? And so we've developed our own systems. We've developed our own technology, our own dashboards, so that if we're building a business, we build it in from the process methodology and the systems we've developed, or if it's a company that's out here, we're going to look to overlay that with our template of technology and operations and format and simply just shave off what's on the outside. And if it fits into what's on the inside, then it easily molds with people who are trained and operating under our current systems and tool sets. It'll just become a transition or change management plan to bring that business in and simply shave off these other areas of cost, operations, manpower, whatever's necessary to trim the fat off of something that's not as necessarily as close as a perfect template as we would want it to be. And that could literally be certain manpower locations, warehouses, or other things if we decide the business is worth it. Otherwise, operational independence is one of our key factors. If they have a warehouse and employees, we will typically pass them over. Because we now know the time and energy it takes to do the change management on that is not worth finding the next business that doesn't have that, but has all other places of operational control where we can trim a little bit less fat and pull the levers on things that we already do really well to increase the value, profitability, brand line, and smooth operations of that business forward. If they're on Amazon, the technology handles itself, really. It's just, it's a little more complicated and it has to be learned. So we've trained people on the management of that, even down to how to just deal with Amazon itself. I'm not an Amazon fanboy. I love the system. I've been on it for a long time. I think it's a miracle the dang thing even works. But it's still like a hammer that can build beautiful things or smash your thumb, or is like what the third device in the world that kills people behind like baseball bats. So you can be careful, right? You got to swing the hammer the right way. Shopify and the other marketplaces are the same way. They have slightly different psychologies of buyers. There's different levels to pull. We have DTC brands that have done 30, 40 million on one side who've done very terrible on the Amazon side. So we help them. We have Amazon brands that are doing 10, 20, 30 million on one side, and we help them open up the presence of Shopify and take those levers. And why? Mainly, we're trying to gain more customer and market share and buy more avatar, but we want the subscription base. So if we can pull Amazon and subscribe and save up to a revenue generation in one company, channel, and then go over to Shopify and bring that up and pull them into a membership or subscription channel, the opportunities between that now is almost equivocal to SaaS exits, 8 to 15x. You build up omni channels with multiple subscription bases, and you can literally get SaaS style evaluations now. When we look at marketplaces like TikTok, which they're just announcing Fulfilled by TikTok, which is basically an attempt to go after FBA and to solve a problem they knew they had to fix anyways, which is products being sold on their platform that are not delivered fast enough and hurt their experience. So they're rolling that out extremely fast. I know Shopify tried that and completely failed at it. So I'm curious to see if TikTok can pull it off. We prefer to MCF or multi-channel fulfill from Amazon to TikTok Shop. So we don't need to use their infrastructure. Amazon is our backbone of logistics. So when we open a TikTok Shop, we simply connect the two, and any orders from Shop go in and get fulfilled by Amazon's logistics system. It just acts like a 3PL in that way. So then we just focus on market creation and brand development through TikTok Shop, and that creates market demand for those particular products, opens up that channel. They don't have any sort of subscription-based model, but I know it's coming. And with the whole legislation, people are like, okay, Neil, I heard you say TikTok, and all of a sudden, blah, 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 the narrative kicks in. They're going to get shut down, and they're an evil corporation, and all corporations should have been shut down there. Don't get me started on historical stuff, because at the end, corporations were a temporary time. They were supposed to be for a purpose, and they were supposed to have an outcome, and then they were supposed to close. They were never meant to run indefinitely. So anyways, historical lesson. But the end effect is TikTok is not necessarily an evil empire. Yes, actually, their data and information is owned in the United States, more than 60% from Chinese. And so don't buy into the narrative. They're not going to get shut down. They might get broken up. One of my friends is constantly on I guess I'm going to call it X. I was going to call it Twitter. Telling everybody that he believes that Amazon should buy or is going to buy TikTok Shop. And I thought, that's an interesting theory, because literally if they just went into the Amazon customer app and gave you the ability to upload and connect like TikTok does to the shop and the product, they would blow it up. Like, you would have 150 million creators overnight. They've made it very difficult for Amazon influencers to get involved in the tracking of the UGC content and its connectivity to the products. And they simply don't make enough for 2, 3, 4, 5% commissions, when I can go over to TikTok Shop and run the same videos and get up to 25 to 30% commissions. So they've got to become more competitive. So it might be an advantage for them to buy. But we look at those omni channels and look at that data, and the psychology is to wrap that whole thing around to your original point. Those are different data points of growth and building that we also look at in the growth and building in an acquisition of a business.
Hey team, have a big favor to ask you. Please pause this episode and send the link of this episode to someone you know that you think would enjoy this content. Really appreciate you spreading the word. This is how we grow. We're not a Joe Rogan. We don't have big, massive advertising budgets, but we absolutely want to grow. We want to get the learnings from all of these episodes out to as wide of an audience as possible, and we need your help to do it. Thank you, and now back to your listening. And what do you think about channel diversification and strategic wholesale? Yeah. We know the DC360 says that by the end of 2024, they're estimating that there's going to be over 1,000 vertical specific B2B marketplaces active globally. So we've gone, and that has exploded. And so just as Amazon is not the only DTC/B2C favored marketplace out there, now there's massive competition on the B2B side as well from a marketplace perspective. So now we've got a whole lot of B2B marketplaces out there that are becoming famous from Wayfair and all the way down. So the question then becomes, how important is it for you, for the brands that you acquire and invest in, for them to establish strategic wholesale routes to market? We've seen the danger when even a formerly successful D2C darling like Allbirds shuns the wholesale channel fastly for years and years and years. We see how they can go down to zero as a public company. And we're seeing that Allbirds is probably going to go bankrupt. Absent some massive changes through wholesale doorways, they're going to probably go bankrupt within the next 12 to 24 months. And so how important is it for you, for the brands that you work with, to get outside the pure D2C or B2C model and say, look, do we have some strategic wholesale partners that we can also sell through?
It's not, I'll be honest, it's not extremely important, since we're primarily D2C. If a B2B opportunity presents itself, obviously the numbers are going to have to work and turn it into an actual sales channel. It's great to say that this, for every brand, it would work in theory, but in application, it doesn't work for every brand. And not every channel was meant to support every brand. And not every customer avatar matches every platform channel. So if I'm taking it and saying, I'm going to take this brand on Amazon and put it on Etsy and Wayfair and Walmart.com, and I'm going to put it in the other marketplaces, you're not guaranteed. That's going to increase anything except your time and maybe your cost expenditure if you're not really looking at it right. So you need to be strategic and we are, and what we move to when the time comes, or where that product or brand line is spending its money and time if it is omnichannel. If they come in and say, okay, we're omnichannel and here's 80% Amazon and 10% Shopify and 5% this and, you know, 5% other, we're going to look and say, okay, where's the biggest effect on money, market, time, energy, and attention going to be placed? And some of those channels may shut down because it's simply not worth spending any energy or time on and optimizing.
Because you're spending 20% of your time on a channel that generates 5% of your revenue, knock it on the head.
Unless its strategic plan has a pathway or an opportunity to grow because market share shows growth penetration and maybe owner or capitalization didn't take advantage of it. At that point, sure, we're going to exploit it. But if we look at it and say, that's been open for 3 years, the most it's ever done is about 20% of the business. It could very well be energy, attention, capital of the operator, but it could very well be just market. It could be market is not really demanded. It's not a great avatar. There's not really a good amount of time. And if it will do 20 next year because it's done it the next 3 years, then we just leave it alone. If it's going to be turning down, and it has a tendency to be turning down, usually if they're not managing it or keeping their eyeballs on it, then we might just say it's not worth it. Let's pick that up and move it to another location. But there are certain channels that tend to sync better with others. And that halo effect of anybody on the web now touching something and ending up somewhere, we now see that Amazon's 5% of the retail market now in the United States, which is insane. It's huge. Walmart would love to be that on the, they're not going to make it if they keep going. But there's market channel opportunities. And the biggest one I've seen in the last year is the connectivity of the psychology of the buyer specifically between Amazon and a TikTok shop. The buyer is very much the same. And you're like, Neil, that doesn't make any sense. I thought it was only like 18 to 25 year olds who were on TikTok. I'm like, no, go look at the data. The demographic growing on Amazon is 40 plus. And the demographic growing on TikTok shop is 40 plus. Matching with the amount of people who have a consumer value and have the ability to purchase larger or more amounts of product and consumable goods. And that's the fastest growing demographic on TikTok. So by proxy, what's happening is they end up on TikTok, seeing the product and not really trusting TikTok. 25% of them are ending up on Amazon and buying the product anyway, or buying somebody else's product. So that's very powerful because the psychology, the buyer, the system connectivity, the SEO relationship of keyword-driven now from TikTok tied to keyword-driven SEO that matches Amazon. And of course, it'll go into the Bing and Googles of the world. If you're getting into bestseller ranking on Amazon, your keywords will then target over to those platforms. Tie that to YouTube with keyword-driven around your products and your advertising, and then switch over to TikTok shops and go after the same keyword-driven organic traffic and watch what happens. That halo effect is very powerful. In fact, it's excluding Shopify over here to itself a little bit, mainly because time and attention to SEO on Shopify is difficult. So you need a very strong paid acquisition channel of some kind
model
until SEO can really ramp up, because it's your own opportunity to SEO on the Shopify side. And so that takes more energy, effort, and of course, knowledge and application to do that. Then you got to get a good channel strategy and you got to pay for that traffic. We all know what's going on with that, right? Meta cost, CPLs and CPMs are all through the roof in a lot of places. You still have to acquire that customer, which means you've got to be stronger on your customer acquisition. You've got to know your LTV at least out to 90 days. You have to be able to acquire them into a secondary channel or a second or tertiary product through that pipeline. It's just a requirement now. If you can track them through acquisition on Meta, through Shopify, and they don't buy and check them back to Amazon, that halo effect, you got to go with that. You got to go with that because they will spill backwards and prove the brand. It may not look profitable at first, and most likely it's not, especially if you're sub 50 bucks now acquiring products through Meta. You've got to be able to get that customer acquisition through to another channel or another location. They're not really spilling over to the TikTok shops. So TikTok shops is spilling back to Amazon. So you've got to look at how that halo effect is in your brand. If you're building with that intent in mind, or a business that is established that is utilizing one or more of those different channels, it's going to be based on their avatar. And some people don't understand that well enough, and they just went open to channel. Why are you doing that? Your buyer's not there, and that's not the best way to capture them. Let's go find out where they actually are and capture them where they stand. And that could be TikTok shops and demand today with the demand creation side of those brands.
And two questions that naturally drop out of that line of thinking. First of all, how important is internationalization for most of the brands you work with? And do you look at that as an expansion opportunity where you're going, hey, Amazon is big all around the world. It's not just Amazon US anymore. Amazon Mexico is just absolutely booming. Amazon Canada, booming. Those are very close adjacent markets. In fact, I suspect that many of the products that are sold in the United States are manufactured, increasingly becoming manufactured in Mexico.
There is.
So what does the internationalization opportunity look like? Cross-border commerce, What does that look like? And then from there, how do you think about those? Because you were saying $200, $200 products, but does that mainly refer to individual items being $200 or more in sale value or in ASP, or does that mean $200 AOV for that particular brand? Or can it be either one?
It could be either one, really. It's going to be most likely a combination of a product that is $200 or plus, or a couple of products that tag into an AOV of 200 or more. I prefer that it's a single SKU of 200 and more, because then I know that person is capable of buying another $200 product or another $50 or a $99 product, which targets more.
And we could push up the AOV pretty quickly by bundling or kitting or whatever.
They're going to come back multiple times in a year, right?
Yes.
So for us to equate that, we look at Amazon's own numbers and try to match that. Amazon's own numbers and its own admission is that a Prime member, kind of answer your first question in reverse, then I'll get back to the first part of your question, is $1,000 in a year on an average for a Prime member. So what do I want to do as a third-party brand with private label on Amazon?
Right? I see. Okay. You want to capture as much of that $1,000 wallet share you can, either with one brand or a combination of brands in your portfolio.
There you go. There you go. Preferably it's in the brand that I'm working. If the series of products, subscribe and save, or additional products in pipeline I'm developing, to which I may have a $100 product that needs to be bought 10 times, either through subscriptions or renewals, or I got to have multiple products that equate to a customer's opportunity to buy $1,000 from my brand in 1 year through the Amazon channel. If you're not thinking about it like that, then you're not thinking about pipeline. You're not thinking about product development. You're not thinking about more market research tests. You're just trying to get that
or CLV or anything, any of that. Yeah.
No, you're just trying to get that home run product in, and you're just trying to wait for that big Lambo hopeful dream thing to occur. And you're not looking at it as a process and mechanism to develop a brand that every 12 months has the ability to potentially get up to $1,000 from a customer on Amazon who's buying $1,000 already from other brands. So why not? So once you pull that backwards, you start to think in terms of what cross market, cross channels look like, in terms of what the value of my time, energy, attention, and money is again, and where internationally, back to your first point, I should go. I have a guy coming in right now who needs optimization and opening the channel on Amazon.com because he's doing over 6 million in the Mexico marketplace. All right. And I see huge opportunity in the United States. We've tried to do it in the United States, but guess what? It's not the same in the United States as it is in Mexico. So if you're going to go international, you're most likely going to need help, because you will not know that the Amazon.com marketplace in the United States is very different than the .com in Mexico.
You need local capability and knowledge and expertise.
You got to know the knowledge. You got to know the avatar. You got to know the systems are different. You got to know the way that they do the intentional buying of that 30 seconds or less customer is different in Mexico than it is in the United States. It's just not, oh, I'll just throw it up there and see it, and it'll sell more in the United States because it sells a bunch in Mexico. It won't work. The same way you can't take it over to Germany and into the EU Union and expect that to happen either, or go to Japan, which is the second largest marketplace, and see that happen. Or certainly don't go to Canada and expect that to occur either, because there's 36 million people in Canada and there's 38 million people in California. So you got to look at where you take your value and where you want to maximize your brand before you start expanding internationally, because other people say it's sexy and it's going to solve the problems of your business expansion in one marketplace when you really haven't taken over market share in that first marketplace anyways. So then you're like, I can fix that problem by going into other marketplaces. That's just like a squirrel moment, just like squirrel, like you're off into another shiny object, right? You need to be strategic about when you open, and then you need to know that when you open it, you've done your market and research competition. You know that your product or brand type has a customer segment in another market, or you've just wasted all your time and money. And if Amazon's pushing it to do it for you, which they will at certain levels, oh, we'll pay for that, we'll do this. Make sure, of course, it's going to be in their best interest, right? Their margin is your margin. So at the end, you're going to want to make sure that you don't just push into things because it sounds really good. You need to push into the business. So when we look at it, expansion for us usually is going to be DTC in the .com, because we start in the .com and move out from there. And there's a lot of market expansion in America, right? America is huge. We buy, we're consumerism. We buy a lot of crap. We do. That's just the way America works. It's opportunity. So you can look at other marketplaces and say, there's a lot of opportunity in there. Yeah, absolutely. But strategically, I will not usually waste that time to go into those other marketplaces for products when I know the change of psychology of buyer is going to be very difficult, right? Now, here's something people should pay attention to. And again, hear what I'm saying. I didn't say don't do it. I'm saying be very smart about when you do it. It's very
selective. Yeah.
Difference, right? Amazon's got a little problem going on with his trademark system. You probably know about this. If I go into the Germany, okay, and I'm an unethical seller, so right for the moment, I'm becoming an unethical seller for anybody listening. Not that I do this, in full disclaimer, but what's happening is they'll go in and register your trademark on a third-party brand inside the like German or other marketplaces, and then claim control of your US.com trademark and brand and basically kick you off.
Wow, that is diabolical.
Diabolical, and completely within the mechanism of Amazon's system. Okay, so how do you defend yourself against that? If you are becoming a seller who is doing six, seven, multi-seven figures, you need to go ahead and internationally open those other businesses in those other locations, even if you're not going to sell there because it's not the right time, but get your brand registered under your trademark in those platforms so someone else doesn't do it under an unethical ability to basically hijack your United States brand out from underneath you.
Wow. Shocking. And how much? So we've seen over the last 3 months, Amazon has announced a whole slew of new charges and fees yes. across all of their services. Everything from charging a fee now where they used to automatically move stock between multiple FBA locations based on their demand planning internally, and they wouldn't charge you for inventory transfers. Now they're going to start charging you for that, even if that inventory transfer is triggered by Amazon and not by you by choice. They're also going to charge you if you just by default send your primary lot of inventory to an FBA location that is not close to where your target market ultimately is or will be, that they're starting to add a whole slew of new fees. I think there was a list of six or seven new fees that they were going to start yeah. adding across almost every layer of their set of services that they offer, and including and up to increasing the costs for Amazon ads as well. So they're pretty much ratcheting up their own Amazon share of wallet, not just your share of wallet, but their share of your wallet. They're ratcheting up those fees. So how big of an impact is that going to have on the profitability of the businesses you work with? Or is it because everyone is going to be subject to these changes that it's just going to force the prices up across the board on all products sold on Amazon? Because at the end of the day, all these costs have to be passed on to the consumer. It's that simple. So yep. do you see this as just a revenue grab by Amazon, or do you see this as a fundamental shift to away from Amazon effectively subsidizing sales on its platform to say, no, we're going to actually pass on all the costs of selling on our platform off to the merchant, ultimately downstream to the consumer?
As I see it in a free marketplace, Amazon is doing what a free marketplace is demanding due to inflation, cost, life changes. So as a global change due to even the gas and price of food in our markets, everything is shifting. And so their cost, logistics, and freight have shifted due to that too. And yes, like every other business right now, they are passing that on to the consumer. It can only go so far before it reaches either a deflationary stagflation or a hyperinflation situation. So something is going to have to change it no matter where it goes. So they're simply reacting to the market. Also, they've got some internal problems in my experience that they're trying to deal with. And that's a lot of bad actors that have come on the platform. And to eliminate the bad actors and certain types of models of selling that they originally started to allow the platform to do as a conception of innovation that they moved into the marketplace. Well, a lot of bad actors and a lot of marketers came in, and when they blew through the system, they forced a lot of compliancy changes and a lot of reactionary changes to the way that they were jacking with the system that was originally built. And for that, they've had to put more compliance, more fees, and more things to clean up the marketplace, to remove the bad actors, to remove the inventory costs of shipping and transporting between places where product is not selling and simply being moved. Okay, to a location that just sets on the shelves and no one buys it, which is terrible for their business model. So again, it's easy to make Amazon the evil empire, but you have to look at their response to the market, the way the consumer base and the capitalist base is working within our country. And of course, the sellers that are 60% of their seller base that are dramatically impacting that ability to reach the customer, because the .com itself on their books is not profitable. They use it as a loss leader to reach their advertising and media empire that by 2026 will become the primary source of profit for their company. It's going to surpass AWS and infrastructure for profitability. So their advertising is now becoming an economic engine that third-party sellers pivot to take advantage of. You pivot like any other market situation, any other industry, whether gas and real estate go this way and you have to pivot that because of cost, short-term rentals, et cetera. Go look at Cape Coral, Florida right now. The whole STR market is pivoting very quickly. Okay. That is a normalized process of business and change. Amazon is simply reacting. Do they have bad actors? Heck yeah. Are they as a company acting bad in the interest of their shareholders? No. They're trying to maximize profits and minimize the impact of negative players in their market, moving products in through warehouses and doing other things just to move product that they're having to return that ends up in some location that doesn't sell. Then they have to dispose of it. That costs manpower and other things they've got to deal with. And so they have come to a place where they're like, great, this is the year we're going to clean this up. This is the year we're going to eliminate a lot of that through cost fee structures and logistical changes. If you are using FBA and not taking advantage of AGL or AWD or third-party logistics in your freight and supply chain, then you are going to become a victim of that. Right? You're going to need to be smarter about how you store products in motion from manufacturing so that they don't need to ship products in intertransit fees. And you can send them to certain warehouses by request and know that's the primary place where that, you know, 80% of that product SKU is reaching the market and 20% has to be distributed so it can reach the other segments of your customer market, which is all data you can see inside of your Seller Central account, okay? To know how to be smart about playing this game. If you are just flipping product for profit, if you're just wholesaling and doing those other things for shop your way to wealth and whatnot, yes, the system is now turning against you. It was turning against you 3 and 4 years ago. You just didn't want to see it. You maybe didn't want to make the change. Maybe you were riding the opportunity. Maybe somebody sold you into a course or a business or whatever and said, hey, this is the right way to do it. You're going to make all this money. And in actuality, if you're not creating a brand, you're ultimately going to be defeated in the market. Brand will be the longest longevity opportunity in your business regardless. And yeah, you can have a brand that does wholesale, but if your wholesale is someone else's product, you're ultimately not going to win. You don't control that market. You're just you're working a job. If you own your brand, you control the brand, you buy the company, and you own the outcome, you actually control where the brand goes, how it manages, and who's impacted by it, as much as you can possibly control.
And what percentage of the brands that you work with are FBA-only brands, meaning they're a sole channel, they're Amazon-only, and they will always be Amazon-only?
Yeah.
And which percentage of your portfolio of brands tend to be omni, meaning they've got at least one other channel other than Amazon that they sell
through? I don't know that exact number, but I would estimate, and I know your numbers, Neil, but this isn't a metric we normally track because it's not of this concern, but it's usually around 80-20. About 80% heavy capture of demand on Amazon because it's 28% of the market, 38% of the market share. Then there's Walmart at about 8 or 9%. And then it goes down from there. So when you look at how am I capturing as much possible online purchasing and e-commerce for my brand, Amazon's the channel you have to be in. As I mentioned earlier, 5% of retail is now Amazon. So that's huge. So I'm capturing that demand. So it is a good portion of where the products and purchases occur for people whose intention is to buy. They're out there to buy. They're not to buy on Facebook. They're not trying to buy on Google. They're not trying to even buy on TikTok. Those are pattern disrupt, pattern interrupt marketing mechanisms you have to use to disrupt somebody's normal part of business to go buy something, where Amazon is, I came there to buy something. I was already intending to buy something. That's why I ended up there. So for us, obviously, some percentage has to be omnichannel. About 20% are, we move them omnichannel to establish brand dominance and find psychology of the buyer and other platforms and places to control acquisition of customers through marketing and other means. But there's a lot of demand to capture on Amazon, a lot. And people are like, well, it's only five figures. No, it can be seven and eight figures. It can be nine figures.
And as we come down to the end of our time together, and an hour has absolutely flown by, and you've got so much good information to share, and I really appreciate your time. How do you think that the other, not only other marketplaces, but other channels, how do you see them? And I know it's gazing into a crystal ball and we don't know, but best guess, how do you think the rest of the industry is going to respond to this absolute, utter, and growing dominance of Amazon from a digital sales channel perspective? How do you think the rest of the market is going to respond to that? Because they're not going to stand still. There's no chance that that Walmart's going to stand still. There's no chance that Target's going to stand still. There's no chance that any of the other major retailers, there's no chance that the other department stores, there's just no chance that they're all going to stand still. Now, a lot of them are just going by the wayside. Macy's is in trouble. Like, we look at many other retailers, massive retail chains in the United States, vast majority of them, they're actually in trouble. But one of the things that I have seen is that through platforms like Locally, which I've actually had on the podcast before, they're creating a virtuous cycle, a virtual connection between brand owners yep. and their wholesale slash retail partners. So they're yep. the retailers that they sell through, they are exposing their inventory. So instead of selling only through D2C or only through strategic wholesale slash retail doors, we're going to have this virtuous cycle where the D2C brand drives foot traffic for their retailers via platforms like Absolutely. Locally and vice versa. Obviously, if I walk into a physical retail store and I see a brand, then I go, oh, wow, okay. If I walk into 10 retail stores and I see this brand, then there's that brand reinforcement. And maybe if I'm not in a rush to buy it today, I might go to their D2C website and I may look to buy it through their D2C website, or I might pull up Amazon while I'm in the store and I might go, can I get this cheaper and faster?
The showroom of Amazon, right?
correct. And so I just feel like the market is behind the scenes slowly starting to take shape
yes.
as a collective, yes. as a bulwark Agreed. Against total dominance and reliance on Amazon.
Yeah, but total dominance and reliance is going to only be what the market demands if other factors don't stop it from occurring or other factors change it. So for example, if Congress were to take away antitrust laws for the benefit of glad-handing corporations, we could see Amazon become the Taco Bell of Demolition Man. It's the only place you get to eat food in the future. So it's yep. the only place you can get products from in the future. So the idea that I could say what the crystal ball looks like would only be determined by who's willing to change the potential outcome of the predictions by making it in their favor. They may change laws that allow Amazon to take over full dominance. But in this plague, are there other free market economy things still occurring in the United States? Yes. Is there still opportunity for building businesses? Yes. I know for some people it feels scarce, but again, money is a river. It moves, it shifts, and you got to move and shift with it. And if you aren't and you're yelling at it because it's leaving you, then maybe you should just stop yelling, take your ignorance down for a second, humble yourself and go follow it, because the money is moving and it is moving into business, building e-commerce and systems and development of operations. That's where it's moving towards. Okay. And AI is a component of that, right? We tie AI into what we do through our systems and methodologies and take in certain processes from 2 to 3 days down to 2 to 3 hours. So AI has been cool in the way that we've been able to utilize it for video and licensing and down to the copywriting and images and other things we use to condense time and produce great output. It's a tool that we've adjusted in the way we do things. And I think that's one of the things businesses have to be doing in their leverage. Competitive marketplaces are still going to be viable. Not all of them will be there. There is one called, I think, Mascari, or I forget even the name of it. But people are like, Facebook Marketplace was great until it became a spammer's haven. And now everybody's moving to that platform, which allows you to do buy and sell trade like Craigslist used to be back in the day, which many people moved to Facebook, and now they're moving to third-party options because of scammers and things. People are pivoting. You just have to know where they're pivoting to move that market. A lot of people have pivoted into TikTok shops now because it is creating huge marketplace and demand. Plus, there's a lot of freedom of information on there, and so other people don't want you to hear what's going on. They don't want you to see what's going on, and so they want to stop that. So they're trying to shut some of that down, not just the free market economy, but the message. There's a lot of stuff you can hear on X and TikTok that you can't hear in other locations. And so there's ways and manipulation. So we got to follow and play the game, and we got to pattern our way through that. But in terms of market share, in terms of chipping away at some of the opportunity, TikTok Shops is doing a great job at pulling that masterfully from the platform of viral and awareness into shopping and purchasing as a connective point, and then attaching the affiliate connection and affiliate creator side to it, allowing creators to not only be held accountable by the system, but get opportunity from the system. I know creators now doing 5, 10, 20,000 a day on creators, right? Just doing the creator side, just being affiliates. I haven't seen that kind of stuff in 20 years. It's amazing to watch how fast this is changing, and they call it, what Business Insider call it, the year of the creator. So guys, if you're like looking for a little side hustle income or whatever, go check out the TikTok creator side. We created a little thing called Simple Profit Playbook, which is a subsetting of our Voltage e-commerce playbook to move creators and UGC content creators within our network to help us power our brands and be able to create the content necessary to support the brand and even support the brand beyond just simple videos, but into brand ambassadorship as we move them out. So again, I think the answer to your question is pivot through marketplaces and pivot this year and pivot into what's moving and see the opportunity for what it is. And again, don't let your excuses miss out on your opportunity because of fear of XYZ. If that's the case, you're never going to change. And if you truly want change, you're going to have to jump into whatever it is. Personally, e-commerce for me is the greatest wealth transfer I've ever seen in my lifetime. from the product and digital product world, and we're seeing that move very fast. A lot of predictions showing, as we open that crystal ball, the last moment here, that by 2040, we're going to have an invert. 95% of transactions will be done in e-commerce and only 35% in retail. So the shift is coming to online currency transaction, physical product and digital.
Especially as boomers die off and the older generation dies off that are physically changes, focused.
That is the shift that we're making, and many factors could change that. But right now, that's the path that we're on. So you either are going to become part of it as a consumer in the material.
Or you're going to become a casualty of it.
Or you're going to be a casualty of it because you simply missed it. Or you're going to not have the opportunity, if you don't take it, to be involved in the business opportunity that is transforming in the digital physical product world. It's a huge upside potential when those who get involved.
What a way to finish this one off, Neil. I appreciate your knowledge. You're just a wealth, a deep pool of knowledge. And man, you're rapid fire. I'm going to probably have to go back and listen to this 3 or 4 times myself to grab all the nuggets out of this.
So I'm looking forward to that.
No, it's amazing. Absolutely amazing. Now, this is the point at which, as we come down to the end of our time together, where I get to flip the script. I get to hand the microphone over to my guest. I get to let them ask me one question, any question they like. It could be personal or professional. So, Neil Twa from Voltage Digital Marketing, what is your question for me today?
If there was someone in my network sphere of influence and capability that I could introduce you to sit down, have a conversation, grab lunch, and pick their brain, anybody you can think of, and it was in my power, who would that person be?
Wow, fantastic question. First of all, I don't know who's in your network that yet. That's hard to say. Look, it's interesting because oftentimes, like I said off air before we even started recording, my goal with this platform of mine that is growing, but small but growing, I want to platform people that wouldn't typically get platformed. So I probably would select someone from your peer group that I think has amazing knowledge that hasn't ever been talked about before, that hasn't been on many podcasts, that isn't well known. I could say the Gary V's of the world. I could say the Joe Rogan's of the world.
Separation is possible, and we might tag them in this. And who could be Russell Brunson? Could be Elon Musk? Warren Buffett. But someone said Andre 3000 one time, and I'm like, hey, that's cool. We might be able to pull that off too.
Exactly. But for me, I've been mostly about trying to identify, and it's oftentimes the way that I discover the people that I have on my podcast is I see their posts on LinkedIn and I go, wow, this person, and then I go to their profile and they got 5,000 followers or something like that. And so I think, wow, this person is absolutely got their finger on the pulse of the industry. They clearly know what they're talking about. They're very intelligent. They're very well-spoken. Maybe they're even creating videos or whatever the case may be, but they just don't have that big of an audience yet. And I'm always trying to get to those people early before they pop off, because I want to be able to be the one that helps to bring them to the market. I want to be able to be the one that helps to connect them to other people. I want to be the super connector myself. And that's even when I go to these conferences, like I'm going to B2B Online Chicago next week. My goal is to be that nexus that joins people together. Oh, Bob, you need to talk to Jane because you guys don't know each other, but you guys are maybe working in the same space or whatever. And I think you guys can absolutely help each other, whether that be content collaboration, whether that be sales collaboration, whether that be businesses doing some sort of collaboration. I just think that the hive mind of knowledge in our industry is mind blowing.
Yeah.
I have been in this industry for 24 years now, and I still, on a very regular basis, come across people that have been in the industry 5, 10, 15, 20 years that I never even knew existed. And I start following them and I start watching what they're doing and I watch the moves that they're making. I watch the content that they put out. And in many instances, they're not putting out enough content. And I think, wow, okay, cool. I see that maybe you post once a month to LinkedIn, but every one of those posts are absolute bangers.
Yeah.
And I'm so impressed. And I just think, God, it's a shame. It's a shame that amazing knowledge and amazing experience you have never gets exposed to the broader world.
You know
world,
why that is
that's
for those
what
folks?
I'm trying to do.
And like me, I don't have some click farm in China putting a billion clicks down on every one of my posts like some social media experts do, allegedly.
Yeah, exactly. And neither do I. And so that's why I just think we just have to have the right intent.
That's right.
And we have to outlast. And like I said off air, you can't lose if you never stop. So maybe it's at 600 episodes or 1,200 episodes or 5,000 episodes that my podcast becomes as big as Joe Rogan, or maybe it never will. Well, I'm okay with
it
that.
Just it's where you're going to end up. Ultimately, is not going to be where you started. The same way people nowadays who've got a degree in biology don't work in biology as a degree or whatever, because that's just a lot of the way it works now. It just doesn't work.
Or even law. People that get a law degree oftentimes never work in law.
You can go down the line. There's a lot of that. Like, I wouldn't expect it to necessarily be where I'm at. But I can tell you the pivotal point when I realized that it was the 301st campaign that actually kicked off after the first 300 in my marketing career failed. So after the first 300 failed, if I hadn't done the 301st and finally figured out what I was actually doing right back in 2008, I wouldn't be sitting here in front of you now. I'd probably be back in a job.
Wow. Amazing. Neil, this has been absolutely amazing. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Appreciate you sharing your wisdom and knowledge, and I can't wait to speak to you again soon, my friend.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
If you'd like to get mentored by Jason for free, head over to greenwoodconsulting.net, scroll to the bottom of the page, and click Get Mentored by Jason.